Marquez on pole position. A good start also from Jorge Lorenzo, who uses the power of the Ducati to go up into the lead.
Hello and welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 568, and we've reached the halfway point of the year already. I'm your host, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me today to talk about the German round of MotoGP from the Sachsenring is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
It's going good, Skyler. I feel honored to say this because we're going to talk about the race at the track that Bob Hayes loves the most, the Sachsenring.
There you go. And for those of you that don't know about that, go back to the very early days of MotoPod to find out what that's all about. Speaking of finding out what the show's all about, this show couldn't be possible without you lovely donors. We finally have updated our list. So for our subscriptions, we have Warren Pond, AJ Pilbeam, Keelan O'Carroll, Nick Saban, James DiPertoro, Alan Fleming, Keith Kovac, and from Patreon, we have Andy Miller, Peter Newell, Steve, you didn't have a last name, so we're just going to be known as Steve, Gary Chavit, and David Johnson. Thank you all very much for donating to the show. Remember, folks, every little bit helps, no matter if it's $1, $20, $200, you know, if you want to throw it in. It keeps the lights on here, keeps us going to the races, it keeps us getting interviews and getting paying for all these services to get this podcast up, and that's who we do it for, is you folks. So we appreciate that. Now, remember, if you want to be part of that, you can always go to the donation page on our website, which is www.motopodcast.com. Right there on the left-hand side, there's some buttons. There's a monthly subscription button, which you can select, or you can do a one-time donation. We are fine with either one, and every penny does help. You can also head over to our Patreon site, MotoPod Patreon, and from there you can also choose to donate if that is how you wish to go about it as well. Now, Jim, we have some errata from last week. Last week, I had mentioned Morbidelli had a foot injury, and that's why he couldn't take place in the event. I was wrong. He actually had a broken finger there on his left hand, which would explain why it was hard for him to ride.
Well, either way, it was a phalange, so you were pretty close.
We were getting there. You know, it was something not sticking out of the body. So, but yeah, he had damaged the left metacarpal on his left hand, so I believe that's his middle finger, if I'm not mistaken. And unless we're doing the thing where you have four fingers and a thumb or metacarpals, all of them, I don't know. We can tell who doesn't have a biology degree here. That's all I'm saying.
Neither do I.
We didn't have any listener feedback this week, but if you do want to email us, and this goes to all the hosts, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We will all get that. Typically, at least one of the hosts will respond to you. A lot of times you will get at least three or four, if not all of the hosts, in rapid succession, viewing their opinions and disagreeing with one another. But enough of that. Jim, let's get to the news.
What we found out about Danny Pedrosa's future is he's going to retire.
We called it.
Yes, we did. You word a press release like that, yeah, you're retiring. Yeah. So he can become a Honda test rider if he wants to. He has that option from Honda. I don't know what Danny's going to do with that, but I think he's going to be some sort of like ambassador to the to Honda. Besides that, Honda really can't let him go anywhere because he knows the secrets of the no lift seamless shift gearbox that's inside of those bikes, and Honda still to this day guards that with some serious secrecy. So Honda's not going to let him get away where he can talk freely about anything. And who knows, they might have blocked his move to Yamaha because of that. And that's conspiracy theory talking here, but anything's possible.
And speaking of which, here's a rumor about anything being possible. About Fabio Quartararo has signed for the second SIC Yamaha or SIC Yamaha, whatever you want to call it, a seat to be, you know, rumored with another rider, Morbidelli. That's not final either. But this had to be a bombshell of a surprise. He's had, what, two good rides here? I mean, we're all excited, but where the heck did that come from?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, I did throw it out there in the one podcast that, hey, why not put Quartararo on the bike? But I was kind of half joking, half kidding about that. Right. I wasn't really serious. But in some way, you know, it kind of makes a little bit of sense, because if Quartararo can ride that speed up and he's got all that edge grip, then maybe that works for the Yamaha, because Yamaha is sort of a edge grip, high corner speed kind of bike. So maybe it fits. I don't know. You know, look at it this way. Some people we think aren't going to be the greatest of Moto2 riders or whatever jump to MotoGP and are absolutely amazing. So anything can happen.
Right. I mean, go look at Zarco and Folger. Nobody really thought they were going to be doing what they did. You know, Folger left, but no one's expected that. I hope Quartararo goes well on the bike. I actually do like the guy, his riding style. I think he had a lot of pressure that 15-year-olds get dumped on them. It was a bit too much, and that might have caused his career to go in the direction necessarily he didn't want it to. And if he can get this ride and do exactly what, you know, Zarco and Folger were able to do, and Cal and Dovi, they're kind of on the privateer bikes, and he's going to be a little more close to factory. If he can get there, run with the big boys, I think that's going to be, you know, great for everybody.
It's going to be interesting.
Yep.
But continuing on, Brad Binder has signed on for another 2 years with the KTM Moto2 team. Yeah, I'm surprised that he did, but essentially, where else was he really going to go? There really isn't a seat open in MotoGP, and KTM sort of has already figured out who they want riding their bikes in MotoGP next year, so we'll have to wait and see where this goes.
Right, and I think he signed on just for one more year, but I could be mistaken.
Did I say 2 years? Well, if I did, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. 1 year.
No problem. But, you know, maybe this was Binder's results. He hasn't had what he wanted this year. But he signed a contract and rewarded the team. We'll get to that later. But he certainly, you know, he's got the stuff. And like you said, though, maybe this was, you know, he's playing the long game. He's sticking around because pretty much at this point in Moto2, you're just going to make a lateral move. You're on a top team. You're not really going to get on a better team. You're just going to get on a different team, right? And KTM has just got this great line for you to go straight to MotoGP. You can go to the Tech 3 team, or you can go to the Factory team, depending on where you are. So he's got his options there versus any other teams down there in Moto2. Unless you are an all-star or a Juan Mir or something like this, it's going to be hard to get into the MotoGP paddock. So, you know, he may be having the best avenue for himself staying with KTM.
Very much.
So speaking of different avenues, Bautista, the rumor was that he is going to be headed to World Superbike. And this was laid on thick by the MotoGP commentators. So much so that, you know, Bautista feels like, you know, he's had the doors closed on him. Apparently him and his management team were quite disheartened that he didn't pick up the SIC seat. And that's what kind of drove the rumors that I think they might have had something to do with putting that out. The Quartararo's got that all signed up, and we couldn't get that seat.
Yeah, this is interesting. Because in all reality, has Bautista done enough to actually warrant the SIC Yamaha seat? I don't think so.
No.
I mean, for him to sit there and say that I got snubbed, well, you know, that's okay. You're entitled to feeling that way. But I think if you take a step back, the results really haven't been there for him to warrant a move of that magnitude. So I could see him going to World Superbike. Sure, why not? He, you know, there's going to be an open seat probably at Ducati to ride the new V4 bike, whatever they're going to call it. So he might logically just slide in there.
It's possible. Now, what is going on with Mark VDS? Morbidelli is under contract with them for next year, but he keeps being linked to the SIC seat. But I don't think Mark VDS has actually announced that they're leaving MotoGP. So this is kind of a mess, isn't it, Jim?
This is something to watch because, you know, Mark van der Straassen, he said that they were going to be there until 2021 because I think that's how long his contract actually runs to. You know, he says he's going to be there, but who is it? Is it Bartholomew who was running the team?
Yeah, he's gone.
He's gone completely. He left only because he said he had, you know, he was doing the right thing for the team and for everybody to keep competing and whatnot. Now, if you're Morbidelli and you're involved in this entire scenario of what's going on in this, you know, basic soap opera, you'd want out. So if somebody's going to throw you a life preserver, namely SIC, well, what the hey, man, jump on it if you can. I mean, we all know contracts are made to be broken.
Right, and it doesn't help to have Valentino Rossi in your corner, you know? That'll help get you some Yamaha pull as well.
Is this the beginning of Rossi stamping his authority on a KTM-esque track from Moto3 to MotoGP? Because really, I mean, Morbidelli, he's on the Sky VR46 team. He wins the world titles in Moto 2, and he goes to MotoGP, and he's on a Honda. You kind of think, well, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but then Rossi doesn't have his own team yet, so, you know, what's going to happen there? So maybe that's the beginning, and he's just going to the SIC team because they're basically a placeholder. I wouldn't put it past Rossi to buy the Mark VDS spots or work out some deal with them to have his team run in those spots. I would watch that, yeah.
Random question for you. Just came to the top of my head. If Rossi was to get his own Yamaha MotoGP team, could he pull a bigger sponsor than the factory team?
Yes. No question.
I think so, too. I think he could be the factory team. If he's got all that money and all that attention, are they going to be kicking down the factory parts over there? Oh, that could, you know, I could just see some friction on decisions. Like, this is our factory team. These are our factory riders. But they've got all the money and all the attention, so we don't want them sinking back. Ugh, what do we do here?
No, well, I akin this to the old Yamaha Roberts team, right? Back in the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. And basically, Roberts was buying the bikes from Yamaha. They were not the factory team. Now, he had the money. He had Marlboro. He had Eddie. He had Wayne. He had Kaczynski on a 250. The thing was, Yamaha gave them every part, every piece, everything that they wanted because they knew that they were the better team than the factory. So they had to support that team. I think the same thing. I think Yamaha is facing the same thing. I think Rossi buys two spots from Mark VDS for the grid. I think his final year in MotoGP is a swan song, him riding on a factory satellite Yamaha with one of his VR46 kids next to him. And that's how he goes off into the sunset. Personal opinion.
Could happen. But we're getting way too far down the rabbit hole in the future. So anyway, Morbidelli, who we were just talking about, he was replaced by Stefan Bradl for the remainder of the weekend after Morbidelli completed just 19 laps in FP1, figured the pain was just too much.
Smart move. I mean, Bradl's a fast guy. He was fast on Moto2, so he was available. Why not?
Yeah. No, he's got MotoGP experience, you know. He was riding the seat before Cal Crutchlow came up, and German, you know, that's just a win-win for everybody. He's a Honda test rider. He gets to come in on the Honda. He's at the home track. Why not?
Why not? So Mika Kallio has torn ligaments in his knee that would require him to undergo surgery. He received those injuries in a crash in FP2 at the race this past weekend. It was a nasty-looking little high side, if anybody saw it.
It sounds like it's more than just one ligament, too. It sounds like he tore his knee up pretty good, because I think he was saying that he believes he sustained those injuries when the bike came back and hit him.
Yeah, he could have, yeah, because the bike definitely took off after him, that's for sure.
So Scott Redding, you know, we all know he's been not really linked to any of the rides except for the test ride, and he's wary of taking the test role. He fears that once you are out of MotoGP, you are out, even if you're a test rider. And his examples were, look at Kallio and look at Pirro. You know, they've been test riders forever, and they get a few wild card rides, but they're never getting back in, which of course is true, because he also stated how, you know, him being 25, he's not that old, but there's always somebody ready to come up, you know, take your place. Some time ago, maybe a couple years ago, they asked him, would he ever be interested in doing World Superbike? He said, no, I'd rather be sat at home than doing World Superbike. And he's starting to soften his stance on that a little bit, where he figures if he could be an Aprilia test rider and also be a World Superbike factory rider, he might take that option. But if that was the only option, he's definitely not looking at that as his first go. And I can't really blame him, seeing how, you know, the way he's mentioned it, you know, once you're out, you're out. You know, you're going to grab a hold of your opportunity and never let it go.
Yeah, he makes a valid point about Kallio and Pirro, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can think that the same thing is going to happen to, say, Bradley Smith, right?
And yeah.
Bradley says he wants nothing to do with racing production bikes. So given what Redding says and what he thinks, then you can't blame the guy to, you know, he's softening, but I think he'll be on a World Superbike somewhere there's going to be open seats, so I think he'll get one. Leon Kamir, he had a crash while testing for the Suzuka 8 hours, and he fractured the C5 vertebrae in his neck. Is he going to be... I don't think he's going to be able to ride in Suzuka, is he?
Nope, he's
definitely out for that.
Yeah, he pulled out, and he's going to take the 10-week, or I guess it's down to 9 weeks, but until the next World Superbike race, the time to get healed up. I mean, this is after recovering from some busted ribs earlier this year. You know, this is the downside to this, you know, to the Suzuka. Sometimes you send your guys over there and they get hurt. I mean, it is motorcycle racing, but I was really excited to see what he's going to do over there, but this guy is not having a year.
No, it hasn't been the year I thought it was going to be for Leon.
Now, according to Asphalt and Rubber, a new BMW 1000 will be coming next year to the World Superbike paddock, and a new Aprilia RSV4 may also be coming as well, both, you know, basically boasting new electronics and more power, which is kind of the way it goes, right? So,
yep.
Just, you know, something a little exciting. Now, with the Aprilia, and then I hear this factory talk, I know Sean Muir has got to be like, oh, you guys better be talking to me, because if you bring in a freaking factory and I'm the one that did all this groundwork here, I would take those bikes out and they would not be getting back any of the data that I put into that, that's for sure.
And it depends on what that contract says, though. That's the thing you got to worry about.
Yeah, but that's true.
I get your point, you know. I mean, those the electrical boffins there, they can take what they want and you will never know. So last piece of news is a sad, sad piece of news. James Calton has died following a crash at the Southern 100 on the Isle of Man. He crashed with Ivan Linton, who is in critical condition. Calton had been contesting the 600 Challenge race, which was the final event of the Southern 100 for McAdoo Racing Kawasaki, when the incident occurred at the Stadium Benz, which triggered an immediate red flag. The 25-year-old was involved with Ivan Linton, who is in critical condition, and Jamie Coward, who suffered a shoulder injury, and Mickey Evans, who had suffered arm and leg injuries. Sounds like that one was relatively nasty, but thoughts and prayers are with the family and friends of James Calton.
It's been a rough couple weeks here in the motorcycle community, and you know, we definitely don't like reporting upon these things. And as we've come to know over the years, it is an unfortunate part of our sport that it is so risky, and sometimes riders lose their lives. But, you know, all the best to their families, and I hope the other guys that are currently laid up have a nice, speedy recovery.
Yep. The Superbike Planet had a very nice article on the William Dunlap incident, and it's the why you race kind of thing and how races are different. It's a few weeks old at this point, but if you go back to their archives and look at it and read it, it's a pretty interesting read into the inside of kind of what makes these guys tick. So let's move on to happier things, Skylar. Let's start to talk about the GP race. How about that?
Yeah, so we started things up with Moto3 qualifying for this weekend, and the big thing that we wanted is all of our main guys up front battling it out. Now, every qualifying seems to have kind of gotten to a groove now. Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP all have a different type, even though they're similar in some respects. Moto3, you go out, you ride for 15 minutes, you get loose, you get the tires, you get used to the bike, you want some changes, and then you go sit in the garage until the last 15 minutes. And then you go out there and stand around the track. Those were the last 6 minutes, I think, when everyone finally came out. But early days, Bezzecchi ended up crashing early in qualifying, which wasn't going to help his cause.
No, that was an interesting crash there, because that was at the turn one going in. And it was kind of interesting. If you watch that crash, it was kind of maybe thinking, you, because they kind of crest and they go sort of downhill into that curve as they head to that apex. And he was holding the front brake, trail braking it in. And I think he had just a little bit too much. And the back end got light on him and he wasn't really ready for that. And the back end just slid out, then caught and flicked him over the high side. Mm-hmm. So he was uninjured, but he left his mechanics a lot of work to do to get the bike back together again. But I mean, think there was still like 38 minutes left in the session when he actually did that. So there was plenty of time for them to get it fixed. But along the way, De La Porta high-sided in the same place, did it sort of the same way. It looked like it was just somebody, you know, photoshopped the different team colors onto the bike, because they were darn near identical to each other when that happened. But Bezzecchi did get back out with 20 minutes left to play and tried to do some damage with that. But The man who actually was doing the damage was Jorge Martin, because he was on fire. He was in the groove, and he threw down like a 126.6 early in the session. And he rolled back into the garage, like you said, and he literally waited for anybody to kind of come chase it.
Right.
And he just sat back and waited for it. Nobody really did, which I thought was really interesting. It was kind of, you know, I really haven't seen that kind of, you know, go out there, put down a really badass lap kind of thing and wait since, like, say, maybe Doug Poland back in the 90s.
Stoner. You know, Stoner was good for that.
Yeah, Stoner was good for that, too. But there was a Martin had more of that cocky Poland arrogance about him on this one that I thought. So more so than Stoner's just, well, hey, there it was, people, go deal with it.
Two laps back. All right, good luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you know, he did. He was absolutely smart. And one thing that Martin has gotten good at, and you can see his experience come to our, is his racecraft. Even in qualifying, he's got some guys behind him. Now, I can't tell if he, you know, got a little loose and gave the wave to, I can't remember who was following him at the time. It was like, oh, sorry, you know, go on by. He tucks right behind him just so he can pull the draft down the straightaway into turn one. And when he gets to sector one, he was already 0.3 up. And I was like, oh, and even the commentators were like, well, that was smart to get the speed into the first corner, because it's not like it's a drag to the line out of the chassis ring so much, right? Just uphill and over, and there you go. But a smart move, which eventually was the move that he needed to grab the pole.
Yep. Yeah. He did run down in the low 126s. He's a 126.4 with that lap, which was very impressive there. And, you know, everybody else tried to chase him. Marcos Ramirez wound up being second quick. Bastianini came on at the very end of it, because I think he had a – he no, it was his teammate Della Porta who was down. Yeah. And then Bastianini came in there. And then you had Amasia, and then Canet was in. But Canet actually was down with a high side too. And again, another
same turns,
looked exactly identical. So I was thinking these guys were trying to leave it as late as you can, and you're trying to trail break to the center of that corner and that apex, and it just it bit them. You know, it was a little greasy and it bit them. But Canet was fifth. Arbolino was sixth. Vizecki, but had come back to get to seventh. He had no confidence in his riding after that crash.
No.
You know, it's one thing if the bike has, like, say, a mechanical problem and it puts you on the ground. You can put that out of your head as a racer really easy, because it wasn't your fault, right? It was there. Hey, there was nothing I can do. The whatever broke in the bike, right? But this was a rider error that caused, you know, a big crash, and it's a very much a feel crash, because again, we're talking about trying to trail brake over this hill and into an apex and on the side of the tire, and that's all feel. And what do you get back through the handlebars to make you understand what's going on? And that shook his confidence is what happened. So he had a lot to do on race day, starting from seventh. McPhee was in at eighth, Sasaki ninth, and then rounding out the top 10 was Martin's teammate Fabio Di Antonio.
Yes, sir. Now, Moto 3, 26 bikes covered by, or excuse me, 23 covered by 1 second. That is a tight field.
Yep.
And we're seeing more of this. I think it's just, you know, we're getting to that point in the year where everyone is up to speed, the bikes are dialed in, the teams are dialed in, and man, it's, when it comes down to the weekend, it, when you're talking about a second separates 23 bikes, it's where you're at, when you're qualifying, when you go out. It's little things making the difference at this point. It's a tenth here, a tenth there, tire pressure, one click on the forks. Who knows? This is where, you know, your team makes the money, and the riders got to go out there and put the effort in for sure.
Yep.
All right, so completely. Let's get on down to Moto 2. This is where we always seem to have all the fun in Moto 2, right? Oh, I'm sorry. This is boring. But but it was a bit different going in. This, they had to get the hot laps in like usual early, because it was abnormally warm in Germany this time of year for this race. It always seems to be cold or even raining when we get to this point in the season at this track. And it was hot. I mean, we're talking, what was Martin's team doing? They were like blowing iced, what was it, they had a, like a freezer, and they had running air through it. They're blowing it down on the fuel lines of the bike to keep the bike cool. Something crazy like that, I think. A friend of the show and MotoGP pit lane reporter, Simon Crafar, he went down and he had to go see what that was all about. So it was pretty damn hot in Germany this weekend. So that track was getting greasier and greasier as Moto2 qualifying went on.
Mm-hmm. Which led to the fact that Pessini threw down an absolute flyer like with 38 minutes left, mm-hmm. and sat there at the top. And you're waiting for anyone to try to knock it off. And honestly, there was nobody who was going to come close to it. It just wasn't going to happen.
No, I think all the fast times were set within the first 10 laps. And yeah. there had been no sub-24-minute laps. And I think by lap three, four riders had already done it.
Yeah, it was bang, 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 bang. And we got into the 124s. And I think Pessini actually broke Zarco's 2015 track record for a Moto2 bike.
Yep.
So that was pretty crazy on top of it as well, especially given the heat.
Exactly. It warmed up so quick. You know, everyone, Sam Lowe's, Maya, and Luca Marini were all under, include with Pessini, under Zarco's lap. Because I think he was like a 124.024 or something like that. Man. Was his. He was close. But yeah, they all got under there.
But I think part of it was the fact that Dunlop had brought a very soft, which would play out a little bit later on.
But once again, who was down in the field that we just cannot understand what's going on with this qualifying?
Would you be speaking of the KTM factory rider Miguel Oliveira?
Yes, I would.
Yeah. I think his goal is to start as far back as possible and win.
Is that what it is?
I think if that's it, he's doing a great job at it. Let's put it that way.
Well, he needs to go look at his teammate for how to do that, because he went from last to first. And what was that, Jerez 2 years ago?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Yeah. So, boys, just run down through the quick here. We're going to do Matteo Pessini. He was on pole, followed by Luca Marini. I believe was his first time he was starting on the front row. And Pecco Bagnaia rounding out the top three positions.
Which is the first time you had three Italians on the front row of a Moto2 race in history.
Woo!
Woo! And you got to do something to make it. You got to do something with Moto2 to jazz it up. And this is about as good as we got.
Oh, man. It was good to see Sam Lowe's back on form. This is the Sam we've been expecting. He qualified at fourth. And it was almost quietly that he qualified there. You didn't hear a lot of play on the TV. It's like, oh, yeah, and Sam's got fourth. It's like, well, dude, that's kind of, we should talk about that. Because he's been having a tough year. It's like, here we go. This is the Sam we wanted. And then Lorenzo Baldassare in fifth. Xavi Virge in sixth. Alex Marquez in seventh. Juan Mir in eighth. Marcel Schwarzer in ninth. Brad Binder in tenth. Fanati, Kent, Augusto Fernandez, Isaac Vinales, Oliver Navarro, Locatelli, Quartararo, Corsi Gardner, Bubba Schneider, Odendale. You know, I wanted to get down because I finally got down. You know, thanks to Lynn, we've been working on Iker Lecuona's name. Ooh, how it just sounds so much better now than when I said no. And just so everybody knows, if you know how to pronounce the name or you speak that native tongue and you hear us butchering it, there's been a couple people that have sent in like phonetic breakdowns for names. Much appreciated. Love it. We always want to get better here on the show. And that was definitely one that was troubling us. And I think we got it down, Jim.
I think you do.
All right. So let's get on to MotoGP. Why don't you lead us off there with a little bit of Q1?
Well, MotoGP qualifying was actually really pretty darn good qualifying session. Most of them actually are, but let's start with Q1. So we had Dovizioso was in Q1, Zarco in Q1, Miller in Q1. And after that, you kind of had everybody else that you expected to be in there. But Dovi had found in the morning, had found serious race pace. And so everybody was thinking, okay, Dovi's going to get through this because he had ran off a ton of 121 lap times. And basically in the first one, Dovizioso basically went out. He put it out there. He was like at the 120s. And then you kind of Zarco came around. He was there as well in the first session. Zarco kind of went second quick. And right as it kind of boiled down at the end, Dovizioso went back out again. I thought he was going to, you know, stay put on that time that he had and not use another tire up. But Takaaki Nakagami came through and actually it took the pole away from, or took the first position away from Dovizioso. And then everybody started cooking in those laps and you're just waiting for it to shake out. And Dovizioso did pull through with a 120 to go on to it. Takaaki Nakagami's lap stayed good enough for him to be second. Aleix Espargaró was then third. Zarco could not make anything work. even though he looked like he had some good sectors going, he wound up losing a lot of it in the last sector and could not make anything happen. Miller was in fifth, Pol Espargaró sixth, then Smith, Hafisaaren, Rabat, Redding, Brattle, Luthi, Arant Simone, which credit to Brattle. I mean, he out-qualified three guys, and for having very little time on that bike and been away from a MotoGP bike for a while and riding a notoriously bad Honda, that was pretty doggone good for him.
Yeah, and he out-qualified his teammate for the weekend, Tom Luthi, who,
yep,
when the announcers were talking, they had gone down and talked to Tom, and he's completely deflated. He can't, yeah, basically he can't get the bike to do anything he wants. He can't understand. He's running circles around the bike. Is it too soft? Is it too hard? Is it, you know, this and that? Nothing. He just can't get any feeling whatsoever apparently from it, and that's a bummer. Somebody mentioned that he has spent maybe too much time down in Moto2 because that's a whole different riding style, different electronics, different setup, different tires, and it's hard to shake those bad habits, which points to why, you know, why Juan Mir wants to get the hell out of Moto2 so quick, because you don't want to develop bad habits that you know, you want to get to MotoGP and ride like a MotoGP rider. You don't want to ride like a Moto2 rider in MotoGP.
That is true. I mean, makes some sense, but I think great riders adapt themselves to what they're given. I.e., you look at kind of how Rainey rode, you look at how Doohan rode, you look at how Marquez rides now, to some extent Rossi, and how he changes things up. So, you know, the good will always be good, right? Just mm-hmm. some good are better than the other good, and that's just all that it is.
It's true. Then we got down to QP2. And of course, it was at this point you're thinking, all right, so can Marquez make it 9 out of 9? It really was anybody but Mark, kind of one of those things where it's like, all right, we know he's going to be fast. Can anybody beat him? That's what you need to watch out for. And it was looking close there for a little while.
Yeah, it was looking close. I mean, Marquez kind of went out there and did his thing, and then guess what? Lorenzo kind of put it on pole, and then here Vinales kind of got something together, and he put it on pole. And the interesting thing that takes place in all of this is that Marquez comes in after his first run on his first bike. He stops, has a quick conversation with his pit crew, and heads right back out again, which told you he was on a three-timed run plan, where everybody else has kind of been on the two-fast time idea, right? Only to make two runs, and Marquez is going to make three runs, right? So in the meantime, here's Lorenzo. He's sitting in the pits on pole. He's got his helmet off, and you know, basically everybody else is kind of sort of battling it all out, and Marquez just keeps going out and keeps running laps, and he goes out, and you're like, okay, well, is it a tire thing? Is he searching for whether he wants a soft tire or the medium tire on the front of the bike, or what does he want? And a soft rear. And then you come back at the very end, and Marquez shows up with a hard front and a brand new soft rear on his Prime A bike, and he heads out to go at it. And time's ticking down, and you still got suddenly, you know, Petrucci's gone to the top of the list. Jorge was there. Again, Vinales kind of was in that group in there somewhere. And then you see Marquez turn in red sectors, and he's got like 3/10 on everybody through, say, the first sector. And all of a sudden, his second sector is nowhere. And you're like, okay, well, then his third sector, he brought it right back up again. Oh, he's going to be close. You know, could this be like the first sub 120? Was it they're trying to get to what, the first sub 120 lap or something like that? And they're like, well, it could be close. And then Marquez's final sector was good, but that second sector was bad. And you're going, well, man, what the heck happened? And the replay shows that Marquez darn near ejected himself to the moon.
Man, and that was basically crazy.
And it's another one of those, you know, classic Marquez saves. But this now put us to the point where Marquez was on the razor thin edge. He just got back around to be able to make, like, say, one more fast lap at it. So there's this drama of, can he knock Petrucci off of the pole, who's now gone to that point? Lorenzo sort of settled in at third, and Vinales is right there in fourth. And Marquez is like the last man standing, and he just threw everything at it but the kitchen sink and turns in that 120.2 lap time, which was just phenomenal. And he only really beat Petrucci by 25 hundredths of a second, which is, I don't think you can blink that fast.
No,
which is amazing. But it was everything you want in a qualifying session. You had the drama, you had the guessing, you had everything, and you didn't really know what was going to happen, but you knew Marquez was going to give it everything he got, or everything he had, and he did, and he got his ninth straight pole. So it wound up with Marquez in pole, Petrucci, Lorenzo, Vinales, Dovizioso with a strong work to get to fifth. Valentino stayed on that second row, which is kind of you want to be in the first two rows to have a chance at it. Then you had Crutchlow, Iannone, Bautista, who had a great run because he was actually in Q2 straight out of the combined sessions, yep. Lending credence to his want to that he should be on the sick Yamaha.
Yeah,
one race does not make that for you, Alvaro. Sorry,
unless you're Quartararo.
Well, Quartararo had two, right?
You know? Two. You had to get to two, Bautista. Then you get to talk. Two,
man. Yeah, so maybe after Bruno, he might be in line for the sick ride. I don't know. And then you had Pedrosa, who was going to retire at the end of the year, Rins, and then Tadaaki Nakagami. So that's how your MotoGP qualifying finished out.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was interesting to see from that, because Lorenzo had Daniilo tucked in behind, and Lorenzo took the top spot, and Daniilo took that pole position. Well, he was holding on a pole with that lap behind him. So what I wanted to see was, you know, was Petrucci going to be a pretender in the next day's race? Was he going to, you know, not be able to hang because he took that on Lorenzo? We were going to see that, and then, you know, 0.6 covering the top 12. Yeah, I'm not going to get sick of saying how close this field is, because I got to make an emphasis on how 0.6, mm-hmm. that's a wiggle in one turn, and you're now in 12th.
Any small mistake at this point will move you about 8 places on the grid, literally.
And it just goes to show you like how good somebody like Marquez is, because you have to be consistently that far over the edge and contain it to be able to do these kind of things, because honestly, 0.6, any of these guys can win a race. You put these guys, just pick your, you know, century or whatever is your decade you want to throw these guys in, they're winners. Mm-hmm. The amount of talent that is stuck here now is amazing. I mean, that's 12 positions, if not further down, that, you know, are only this far back. It's special how much, you know, how good these guys are. And I can't imagine the kind of pressures they must deal with to maintain these seats. It's tough.
Yeah, that's why they're doing what they do. And again, you sort of have that top 10 of guys who can sort of deal with that pressure and do it week in, week out. And then you've got the other 10 guys that kind of are somewhat interchangeable. All right. And that's the nature of the beast.
So now we got some Moto3 race. We had 28 hot scorching laps coming up. And with Martin on pole, he gets out there and gets the whole shot. Right with him, though, was Ramirez. Now, Ramirez, it seems like he's finally found his form. He was good in qualifying. He was running up there early in the beginning. And it was good to see that, you know, he's made his way back up after having a lackluster, for lack of a better word, hat, no pun intended, start to the year.
Doing well. You know, Martin, using his strategy, let's get out front and kind of go. Bastianini fell back to 7th right at the beginning, which was not the direction he wanted to be going in, especially, man, considering that, you know, he was starting well.
Dude,
you know,
he threw the fucking anchor out this race.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that.
No.
And then, you know, things kind of settled in a little bit there. And then Bezzecchi and Martin were both out front, and they kind of start to pull away a little bit. And I was thinking, dude, we're going to get a straight fight between these two, and this is going to be a knockdown drag out, but that's not exactly what happened.
Sure didn't, but we had a couple of riders that they were looking up there in the good. Tony Abellino was looking real strong. He's, you know, not really a big-time podium player, but he's looking strong up there. And then, you know, DG Antonio had his first crash of the season, you know, loses the front end and crashes out and almost takes out his teammate, which was...
Yep.
A bit scary for the championship there. I was like, oh no, is this going to happen to Martin again? He's taken out by somebody. Like, okay. But he was able to gather himself and kind of slot back into fourth. And then we lost Nacron after Puvifat. He crashed out with about 10 laps to go. And then, you know, with, you know, getting into those final 10 laps, there was still a huge freight train of riders going around. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the top was starting to split a little bit, but Bastianini, his woes just finished up his day. He ended up crashing out with about 5 laps to go, and he looked pretty banged up. I don't know, did you get any further information on you know, how he came out of that crash? Or
no, I didn't find anything yet. It was a bad high side that took him down, and hopefully there's nothing wrong with him, but And he looked like he just got the wind knocked out of him, but I have not got any medical update on that.
Right. And then Lopez, and it was Lopez and Bastianini that were actually involved in that. Bastianini went down, and he washed out and took out the front of Lopez's bike, and they both went tumbling down. I believe it was turn 12 they were going to, so really fast turn. And you know, like you said, they went tumbling through the gravel there. And it was about that time that Jorge Martin was like, all right, boys, it's been fun, but I'm going to go ahead and pull the pin, and he just disappeared.
Yeah, Martin, I think, kind of rode a Marc Marquez-esque kind of race.
Mm.
He played it smart. He rode in the pack. He kind of conserved his tire a little bit. Didn't do anything stupid. Made sure that he was still in touch with everything. And then at the end, when everybody is thinking that they got him covered, he just simply pulled the pin, took off, and said, you old guys, this is the pace that I got inside me. And if you want to, come along for the ride. If you don't, well, that's fine too. And that's kind of how it came down. What was interesting too is like you get down right like about three laps to go. Was that Rodriguez and Ogura? They had fallen with each other. And what was interesting was it was the fact that Ogura was on the inside, well, on the inside, and Rodriguez was coming back in, and he didn't see him. And at first, I thought it was Ogura's problem. Like, you shouldn't have been there. But then, you know, looking at it later on, different angle, you see Rodriguez come into it. Well, when they fell, Rodriguez kind of has it. But what happens is Oruguma's foot actually smashes into the rear tire of the bike and knocks him off.
No.
It was kind of weird. I mean, it was kind of funny. He's sliding backwards and boom, he hits him with his foot. And, well, that just knocks it out, which shows you just sort of that knife edge that Moto 3 bikes are actually on with their grip on the side, just how much that they're dependent upon that.
I didn't even know that. That's insane. I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, go back and watch. If you got a chance, go back and look at it. Watch it. It's literally his foot winds up just smashing into the sidewall of the tire and just knocks it out. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, yeah. So Martin is up, you know, pulling it home for the win after a very strong race. He was followed home by a championship competitor there, Marco Bezzecchi. John McPhee getting his, I believe that's his first podium of the year.
So yeah, it's good to see podium in a year, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. John McPhee having a nice run there. Followed by Marcus Ramirez, another solid result for Marco. You know, this is, you know, like I was saying, he hadn't had the best start to the season, but it looks like he's gotten back on form. Aaron Canet in fifth, Juan Macia in sixth, Jakob Kornfeld in seventh, Philip Otto in eighth, Raul Fernandez in ninth, Ayumi Sasaki in tenth, Adam Nordin in 11th, Andrea Mingo in 12th, Lorenzo Della Porta in 13th, Nicolo Bulega in 14th, and Kazuki Masaki is in 15th in your final points score. That was really, there wasn't anything too surprising. I said when it came out to when the final results after all the shuffling that went on during that race, I have to say that's, you know, heading into the summer break, where everyone kind of finished is kind of how I see the championship right now. There's a few oddballs in there, right? But for the most part, it's like, all right, I think we've kind of established who the big players are here and who the usual front runners are.
Yeah, the pattern has emerged, you know, for what's happening in Moto 3. We expect Martin and Bezzecchi and, you know, Ramirez, Kennett to be there or thereabouts, roughly. McPhee's kind of the wild card, kind of bounces in and out, and so does, like, Kornfeld and Rotel. They all sort of move around and whatnot. But the order of which we see things is really shaping up in the championship, because now Martin leads the championship on 130 points. He's 7 points ahead of Bezzecchi. Then Canet is there with 92. Fourth is DG Antonio. Fifth, Bastianini. Sixth, Rodrigo. Kornfeld, seventh. Mino, eighth. Ramirez, ninth. And then Della Porta is 10th. And really, the race is between pretty much between the top three guys. And if anything, it's really probably between Martin and Bezzecchi. And you got to wonder if Bezzecchi's not starting to sort of find the pressure getting to him a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, these are teenagers and you're on a world stage, and it's, you know, I think, like we said at the beginning of the year, this is Martin's title. And I think it's just the beginning of it. It's just been, you know, bad racing luck. That's really kind of kept him from having a much bigger lead at this point than what we expected. But I think Bezzecchi's going to learn a lot from this year, learn about what he needs, and then come back really strong next year.
Yeah, he's going to be a favorite for next year for sure. Absolutely.
Totally.
Now, why don't you run us through what happened in Moto2?
All right, Moto2. So, interestingly, Dunlap pulled the soft rear tire from the race. They said it was too soft, it wouldn't last, and that kind of goes with maybe why we saw all those laps at the, in the 124 or the 123 laps in qualifying. So basically, everybody was on all the hard options, and nobody was allowed to be on the soft. So when we started off with the race, it was Marini, Bagnaia, Pessini, Marquez, Lowe's, and Mir. Oliveira got off a great start from, I think, his 17th qualifying spot to get into 9th. And then Oliveira had fallen back a little bit to 13th, but because he went out of the seat and basically kind of almost bumped into Vierge. Then we wound up at the very beginning. Pessini went down at turn 13, and he almost gets Bagnaia. I mean, Bagnaia's got to literally go off track, runs almost all the way to the tire wall, and then basically comes right back on. And as soon as you see that part and everything there sort of settles down, Baldassare high sides himself off at turn 2. So there was all kinds of crazy action that was going on there at the beginning of the race. Right. And you know, you were like, whoa, what kind of Moto 2 race are we going to get here? Because now this had sort of really shuffled things, because Bagnaia was now way down the field. And, you know, he was really far down. And, you know, the question was, well, who the heck's out front? Well, you know, you had Mir out front now at this point. And then you had Marini, and then Mir and Schrader. And the man who kind of came to play was Brad Binder. He showed up there, and he had good race pace going. And he looked threatening the whole time. And I thought that Mir was going to win his first Moto 2 race. Because you thought, okay, this is it. The people that Mir's had trouble beating or racing against aren't there now. And this is his opportunity to kind of reach out, grab that brass ring. And he had a good qualifying session. Yeah, let's see what the kid can do. Well, the kid that did it was Binder. You know, he had signed that contract extension for the year on the KTM IO squad. He was looking menacing. He was threatening. And you sort of had that stalking effect going on. And you knew it was going to happen. Sooner or later, Binder was going to get by. And he did. And he wound up getting by. And he was at the front. Now, then it became sort of like an Oliveira watch, because, well, where's Oliveira? Well, he started to pound his way through, and he wound up making his way to 5th. And you're kind of also looking at a Bagnaia watch, too. You know, you're trying to figure out, like, how far he was going to get back there. But it became a race between Binder, Marini, and then Mir, Schrader, and Ortel. Oliveira. And that's where the race actually gets to. And you had Oliveira charging. Binder was in control the whole way. He winds up taking the win, which was great. Mir winds up coming home in 2nd. Marini was on 3rd, which is his first podium, looking great. Oliveira had raced his way to 4th. Lowe's looked good in 5th. Schrader was in 6th. Xavi Vierge in 7th. Simone Corsi in 8th. And Quartararo had rode his way up to 9th. And 10th was Navarro. 11th was Gardner, still getting over those two broken feet or ankle thing that he had from the motocross crash. Then Bagnaia raced his way into 12th, so he did get some points for it. Alex Marquez, who had a very bad crash in one of the free practices, because he was riding sort of hurt.
Yeah, it was either that or I'm trying to remember when he did have a crash. It wasn't warm up, I don't believe.
No, I think it was,
because I'm thinking of a Spargo, I think, at that point. But yeah, did, and it was kind of like the him back. Bagnaia made his way forward as Marquez made his way back, and you could tell that wasn't your typical Marquez. He had no fight in him. He was just maintaining. Nothing. No, he was maintaining, and he was definitely, the commentators say, walked by him, and he looked completely ghostly white because he just looked so sick. I was like, ooh, man, that's going to be a tough race.
Yeah, it's a shame. The Moto2 races have not been that great this year.
I've had a couple good ones.
There's been a couple good ones, but I mean, this one had all the action at the beginning, and at the first 5 laps, everything kind of really had settled down, and the finish is what you want. But seeing Binder and KTM win, I thought was good. It was good to see KTM win again. I kind of was wondering if there for a little bit, would they ever actually win again? Especially with the struggles Oliveira has going, but it seems as though maybe Binder's figured out how to qualify, and maybe Oliveira needs to look at a little bit of that data that Binder has to maybe get him a little farther up on the grid. But there's no denying Oliveira is like a master of the hole shot. He just blows past people in the starts. And it is interesting to watch him, yeah, to come through the pack.
If he could just get himself up to the damn second row, he could be first to get the whole shot with the way his starts are.
There's no question about that.
Guys, he's got to fix his Saturday woes, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be spending some time in the break here. We call it the summer break, but it's all of like 2 weeks, pretty much.
I think it's 3 weeks. It's three weeks instead of four because we've got 19 races instead of 18.
Right, and some of these guys are off to Suzuka, and I remember, you know, people talk about like, oh, why can't we get a lot of the big names over there? It's like, well, shit, these guys got to rest, man. It's hard to fly halfway around the world for an endurance race and then fly back and have your time zone and fatigue and no thanks. That sounds like a lot more trouble than what it's worth. You do it once and that's it, you go home.
So let's run down the points as we have it in Moto2. Banyaya is out front on 148 points. Oliveira is second on 141. So 7 points between those two. They have definitely put some space on Alex Marquez because he's only on 113 points. And then Mir is now fourth on 95 points. The title is between Banyaya and Oliveira, definitely, unless something crazy happens, but I don't see that actually happening. And I'm hoping Oliveira finds his form like he did in that last third of last year so that this title fight goes down to the end of the season. I'd really like to see him kind of duking it out at Valencia in November. But after Mir in fourth, it's Baldassarre fifth, then Binder, then Vierge, Schroeder, Quartararo, and Pacini rounds out your top 10 in Moto2 points.
Right on. So now we get to the MotoGP race, and there was a couple questions we had at the beginning. Can Marc Marquez make it 9 in a row? Aleix was not going to make it. He had his crash of warm-up left him. I think he had some bruised or broken ribs and had what they call like a thor something, I think, with his, you know, with his basically his chest and lungs and everything he uses to breathe, esophagus had gotten really deeply bruised. So he was off to the hospital. Vinales, could he make a good start finally? Is Petrucci the pretender that, you know, some people were expecting him to be after just following the rims around to go that lap? And Pol Espargaró, he led warm up and, or was it FP4? I think he was leading.
No, he led warm up because KTM was stoked because it's the first time they led a warm up. That's the first time they led anything on their MotoGP bike.
So like, what's he gonna do? We get the race started, and turns out Paul thought he was faster than he should have been, and he crashed right out with Rins early in turn two, right there. So his race lasted two corners along with Rins, and he also managed to mess up Iannone. So Suzuki was not pleased with Pol Espargaró with his move there. So then we get the Lorenzo had a great start, which is something we're used to seeing this year, but unfortunately, you know, it was the Lorenzo of old where we start to lose the tires. But you know, speaking of things that are seeming old, Vinales got out, had a good start, and then he threw the anchor out the back and started sliding backwards. But I'm going to have a good talk with you when we get done with MotoGP. I want to go through some stuff here on the notes. We're going to talk about Yamaha and their stuff. Okay. Now, Nakagami, unfortunately, after having a great qualifying, crashed out in turn 13 on lap 3. And then we're just watching Vinales go back. He went from 3rd to 8th in 6 laps, so same old gremlins were kind of turning.
What was interesting during this time frame was that actually Bautista was actually the fastest guy on the track.
It's true.
And there was nobody faster than him on there.
Trying to get that contract, much like who used to do that all the time? Was it, I think Marco Melandri was good for that. Come contract time, he would put in the banker laps. I think Elias might have been like that too.
Yeah, I think he was, yeah.
But anyway, so then we had, you know, Kyle Crusher, he crashed out on lap 8. We're gonna talk about that afterwards as well. And then this is where the race pretty much was turned on to the Marc Marquez show. He makes his move going into turn 12 after sitting back behind Lorenzo and kind of catching him and studying and letting that front tire heat up or get comfortable with it. And then that was it. Goodbye. And he was off to the runs. Then it was Rossi's turn to chase down Lorenzo. And you can see it was, you know, Lorenzo was losing pace quick. Even at this point, you can see he was not able to keep his pace. Rossi didn't have struggle to get by him.
Yeah, but Rossi didn't have to worry about it getting by Lorenzo because Lorenzo had ran wide at 10, and you knew his front tire was like basically it turned to jello at this point. There's no way he was going to keep that pace. I mean, he threw the anchor out and went backwards.
Yeah, more so than a Maverick. But once again, same thing. Maverick all of a sudden puts in like he lights up red right there. Maverick Vinales, fastest lap. And I think at this point there was something like 12, 13 laps to go. And I'm thinking, like, I have it here in my notes. Can he make it to the podium? And he seemed quite far back, and this track is notoriously hard to pass on just because it has a lot of quick, tight turns and not a lot of straightaways. So, you know, if you're not making it through the corners, and there are a lot of those back-to-back corners, those change of directions where you can't really get set up for them, you know, it's going to be hard for him to make his way to the front. Rossi had a steady race. The Yamaha really did look on better form, though, heading into this. We ended up, you know, getting out to the win. Mark Marquez gets your he goes 9 for 9, which is impressive. You know, we shouldn't make little of that, you know. Every race he's had there.
That's a feat.
Yeah. Every single world championship race he's been a part of there, he has won. That is amazing.
He's had pole and won.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is even more impressive because nobody could beat him to pole and nobody could beat him to the race win.
Absolutely. I love this word because we don't have Nick Harris saying it every other week. No, but it was a masterclass.
There you go.
I should say I love those two words, not just one. All right. I get it.
If you put it together, it's masterclass.
There you go. But we had two Yamahas on the podium. Rossi and Vinales actually did end up making his way back up to the front. The late last lap heroics. Petrucci, he had the sad face going on. He lost pole at the last couple of seconds, and then he lost his podium there in the last couple of corners. I think he got passed. Literally, it was like either 12 or 13. He just got passed and sliced under by Vinales, who was tearing it up. And, man, it's one of those things. We've been saying it week after week after week. If he could just have a good bike at the start of the race, could he challenge Marquez? Because he sets some burner laps at the end of a race. He really does.
He did, yeah. I mean, he definitely had pace at the end. It's just he needs pace at the beginning. And he's got one lap pace in the bike because his qualifying is not horrid.
It's the starts. He's got the same problem Ben Spies had. He needs to ring him up and like, dude, was there anything that you did to help with this? I don't know. they've got to get that figured out. So that leads to Mark Marquez gets the win heading into summer break. Like we said, 9 for 9. Valentino Rossi in second. Matt Vinales finishing out the top steps on the box. And then we've got Daniello Petrucci, Alvaro Bautista, Jorge Lorenzo, Andrea Dovizioso, Danny Pedrosa, Johan Zarco back there in ninth. Not too bad of a race. Once again, I'm going to talk about some stuff, like I said, about the Yamahas. Bradley Smith, you know, a solid top 10 there for Brad on the KTM. Not a bad one.
First KTM home.
That's right. Hafi Siren continues to quietly, you know, impress everyone back there. You know, he top rookie again back there in 11th. Mm-hmm. Andre Iannone in 12th. Tito Rabat, 13th. Jack Miller. And don't let that 14th look like, you know, a mark against Miller. He also got ran off the track in that early spill of pole where he had to go all the way out to the wall.
Yeah,
was dead too. Last and made his way back up to 14th. That's not a bad ride for Miller at all. He, you know, he had to be pretty pissed because that probably, you know, I would say he probably could have had about four more spots with the pace he had. And then Scott Redding, Stefan Bradl, not too shabby with his return to GP, ahead of Luthi, Abraham, and Xavi Simeon. Alrighty. Now, Jim,
yes,
it's all exciting. It's all good. We'll get to the points here. I think everybody knows where we're at. The order they finished was the order of the points.
pretty much that way. And Marquez is getting to be a much bigger lead than before.
Yeah, it's kind of the fight for second now between teammates Rossi and Vinales. So if you want to run, we'll run down here just through 10. Marquez, Rossi, Vinales, Dovizioso, Zarco, Lorenzo, Petrucci, Crutchlow, Iannone, Miller. Folks, it isn't much exciting through there. It's going to be second and the battle for third between them. So second's got two riders and third's about four or five riders. So keep an eye on
easily,
that.
Yeah. But easily that many.
It's Marquez has one hand on the trophy. That's for sure.
Definitely.
Now, okay. Let's get to some stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. The race is exciting, but I want to talk about this stuff here. So I've been thinking about this today and I figured Jim would be the perfect person to bounce this off of. Now, Kyle Crutchlow. He's got some quotes here that I took from an interview he did with Crash.net. Now, he was saying the reason he crashed was basically his front tire got too hot. I gave it my all, and it didn't work out. The front tire was too hot, too much pressure. Same story when we are in a group. We can obviously evaluate after the race and look at what is happening to the tire. We know from my feeling on the bike, it was getting worse and worse each lap. I knew what was happening, but I've had it in a lot of the races this year and had to manage it. Today, unfortunately, I didn't. We looked at the data, and three laps earlier, I went faster than I did on that lap. It is a grip issue from the front tire being too hot. We try all the tricks of the trade to pull out of the slipstream, to not sit behind other guys, and try to turn later and tighter to avoid the heat. Now, this is what's important. As you saw, Mark, he seemed to play it perfectly by sitting in second with the gap to Lorenzo. The front tire was good. Lorenzo made a mistake, and he passed and got the fresh air. Now, Crutchlow says his crash was from an overheating tire. Not once in there did he mention that he also blew that corner about a foot and a half or so and got off the line, and that's where we saw a couple crashes in Moto2 as well. But how much of this, Jim, is what's going on because he's in a pack? And how much do you think this is kind of I don't know about all of that, dude, being in a pack. You know, in cars, it kind of makes sense. He's riding back there. He says he's riding out. And he says the tire's getting hot. But to me, for some reason, I didn't see this as like, yeah, that doesn't seem quite what's right was going, because Marquez and Danny talk about they can't get the heat into the tire to keep it good. And then Marquez has to run that hard to build the heat to where he wants it to ride it. Danny can't get any heat at all. And Cal's like, yeah, it's heating up too much and I'm crashing. What's going on here?
There's a lot in this that Cal spiels. And I think my opinion is that it's kind of Cal talking but giving you the half-truths that are in it. Mm. So the first part here, he says that, you know, the front tire was too hot, too much pressure, and the same story when we're in a group, okay? I'm not going to believe, unless the Michelin tire guys come and, you know, out and say this, that running in a group causes the tire to get hotter. I'm not going to go with that one. Now, do I think his front tire was hot and had developed too much pressure? Probably so, because the side of the tire that he crashed on was the left side of the tire. And we all know Sachsenring has, what, 7 left-handers all in a row till you get to the waterfall, which is the first right-hander, and then you go back to having lefts again. So you could put, conceivably, you can put enough heat in the tire through all of those lefts to get it hot enough that you're going to change the air pressure in it. You change the air pressure in the tire, you change how the tire feels, and voila, you're going to go down. Now, for me, given that Marquez is on the same bike, same tire, and doesn't have a problem with it, I think it's more to do with Cal sort of missing the apex of the turn and being out a foot and a half. Now, he could have been out that foot and a half because the tire was too hot, mm-hmm. and it slid on him a little bit, and he was trying to save it out there, but he got out into the dirty part of the track, and it went down. But I'm not gonna buy that whole, hey, we're riding in a pack and got the tires are too hot because of it. To me, the first thing that would happen if you were riding in a pack like that, the engine itself would overheat. Now, I've had that happen when I was racing bikes. You know, we used to go to this one track in Rockford, Illinois, called Beloit, in South Beloit, and basically you rode around, and there was only one real long straightaway. So if you had rode the whole lap behind another guy and came onto that straightaway and you stayed in the slipstream, you would see your temperature gauge go up and get to where it was being very hot. And as soon as you ducked out of that slipstream and you got all the fresh air back across the radiator, the temperature immediately went right back down again. So I would think that he'd have more of a problem with the engine riding in a group than he would with the tires. Because heat is definitely what you want, but you don't want too much. Now, that being said, if you are having that problem and you know that problem exists, and I don't know, I'd have to check the rule book here on this one. But I believe you're free to run a range of tire pressure. Now, I think there is a minimum pressure that you have to run in the tire.
Always. That's a call from Bridgestone or Michelin as well. Yeah.
Right. So there's some parameters that Michelin wants that tire to work in, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that where the rule book confusion comes to me in is that, okay, well, when does that tire pressure got to be checked? They're spot checking it on the grid, aren't they, I think?
Probably.
I think they are. So you could conceivably, if you're a Crutchlow, run the lowest tire pressure setting that you're allowed to run by Michelin at the beginning of the race if it's going to get hot. And then you would build in to say, let's say you got a range of, say, 10 PSI that you could move that tire to or from, right? You could start down the low end of that range and work into the middle of it, or maybe to the top by the time you got it hot enough. I mean, that's you bedding that tire in as you're going through and running the race. So that's what I'm thinking is going on with that. Now, when he talks about Marquez here, and he talks about it playing it perfectly and sitting in second and having that gap to Lorenzo, I don't know about that. Yeah, Mark was behind, and yeah, Mark kind of sat there for a little bit, but I'm wondering if it was more to do these aerodynamic winglets that are all over the bikes, you know, and it just was being disrupted a little bit. So Marquez, when he wanted to, was able to get close to Lorenzo and didn't have a problem whatsoever. Now, he did have a little bit of trouble going down the hill in the waterfall because the Ducati would kind of pull and accelerate away from the Honda that little bit. That's why Marquez would make up a lot of that distance on the brakes going back into 12, but he was also carrying a whole lot more cornering speed than what Jorge could because Jorge's tire was disappearing on the front. So he was then able to pass Jorge going into 13 and then turn and go up the hill. There's some truth to what Cal says, but I'm not buying all of it. How's that? Long explanation.
You know, top of the game, they may be running the lowest pressure already. And maybe that's why he's talking about the struggle, right? It's like, maybe. It's a known issue, and there's basically, he's kind of also saying in there, there's nothing I can do about it because I have to maintain this low pressure to just be able to have the right tire. But this also may be we have to run it at this specific temperature because at the middle of the race, the end of the race, the tire comes really good, and I need to watch the beginning of the tire. Who knows? I just thought it was a lot of interesting stuff that, you know, Cal, he likes to say, it may be controversial, it may not, but he always makes good talking points. He's going to give you more information. What other writers have come out and tell you exactly what's going on with their tire? None. They just go, oh, there's something with the tire, something, something. I mean, it was great information, and it was a great talking point. And he wasn't done there because something else that, pricked up my ears, or I guess, you know, my eyeballs, whatever you want to do. He continued the interview. He was talking about Maverick Viñales and Rossi, which he both sat behind. Now, if we go back to the end of the race, you stick a microphone in front of Viñales and they say, how do you feel about your third place? Third place is great, but I'm struggling still at the beginning of races. I cannot get out of the corners, the electronics, the tire. And, people are starting to be like, oh, man, it's a broken record, Maverick. But what's strange is Cal said that Valentino looked like he was the one that was struggling with the rear. And Maverick, like his rear looked fine. And they had different tires. So that got me thinking, how could Maverick be complaining about his tire and his electronics, even though Valentino was the one that looked like he was struggling? And I went with two ways. One, that Maverick looked good because he wasn't getting loose because he had no power from his electronics. His traction control was so restrictive that he wasn't sliding the tire at all. So he can't get any acceleration out of the corner like the other bikes. And that's been a big complaint of guys who were used to riding without electronics and now have to, is that they have to deal with traction control. And it's like, how much traction control do you put in there? Like, you need to put in some to keep you from getting bit. But at the same point, you want the rear a little loose because that allows you to control your power. And Rossi was sliding around, so maybe he's got his turned down. Maverick has his turned up. I don't know. But then they interviewed Zarco. And I know I'm running on with this, but it all comes together. He had they were talking about him, like, oh, how's he feel about his racing? And, he's down on his racing because we're so used to seeing him up there even battling for the lead. And then now he's been back mid-pack. And he was saying, I don't know how I can get it to the front. And here's a quote. I won't even butcher it. I would say the same because even with the soft tire, you go for your first lap in qualifying and you're already sliding. When you slide on your outlap, you really wonder how can you push more to beat your opponents. All right, so he's sliding around a bunch in the rear. Maverick can't accelerate, and I'm guessing because he was sliding around the rear because he talked about how it felt like ice, and now Rossi's been sliding around the rear. This all lines up with Maverick has been talking about this whole time. They've got a problem with the rear end of this bike, and it's costing them big time against bikes like the Ducati and the Honda that has some serious grunt out of corners.
Yes, there's something at the rear. I think we've gotten to that point long ago. And here's the thing. I'm not so sure that it's actually the rear that's the problem in the Yamaha, despite what everybody says. Okay. Here's why. One, at the beginning of the year, Zarco looked damn near unbeatable on that thing. Again, different chassis, right? The chassis that was basically designed for Bridgestone tires. Rossi has now started to look good again with it because he's got his qualifying halfway done. So Rossi's got something going on. And I think it's all basically set up because the old school Bridgestone tire, the rear was crap. It had basically no grip. So what you did is you would bias some weight towards the back of the bike to try to give you that extra grip, a mechanical grip basically, to get you off of the corners. And then you sort of got rid of the wheelies with the anti-wheelie traction control kind of gizmos to keep it driving straight and driving forward. The Michelin tire always has been, always is, about having really good rear grip but not real good front grip. So consequently, I think what's happening in the Yamahas is these guys are in the corner, the front end starting to get to where it's being pushed by the rear because we've got too much traction, which causes us to want to open the throttle back up and try to snap the rear around and unload the front to take the weight off of it so that you can turn the bike. And if you want to try to get the bike to turn and you've got the traction control turned up, like maybe Vinales has, it's not going to turn. And that's why he's never putting down black early on to turn the bike and pivot it, right? Mm-hmm. And so Rossi has kind of gone back to riding a Yamaha more like how Rossi rode a circa 2005, 2006 Yamaha. And I think he's kind of going back to setups that are in that way a little bit. And Rossi's figured out that he's got to take as much weight sort of off the back of the Yamaha, and they're either using a rear suspension link or the position of the forks and the triple trees, something that they're doing to try to take the weight, put a little more weight on the front to make the front work a little bit better for him. And then that's where he comes in. Now, I also think this because Vinales has been to the point where he has come on strong at the end of the race, right? So he's worn the tire down, and now he's on a used up tire or near used tire. He's got a lot of traction control turned in on the bike. Now he's able to ride it, and he looked like he had some edge grip that nobody else had during that race because he was passing them on a short little section between 7 to 8. He was definitely getting past everybody because he was carrying more corner speed through the waterfall heading into 12 and through 13. Well, if you've essentially, quote, saved the tire by using the traction control, now at the very end of it, you've lightened the fuel load off and you're not having as much weight on the front again. Now the bike becomes way more neutral and it's way easier for him to ride that bike and go fast at the end of the race. All of this then kind of falls apart because Zarco has now suddenly become nowhere when he used to be everywhere. And you got to think, well, it's a satellite bike. We know he's not getting any extra parts from Yamaha or getting any of the newer spec parts and pieces from Yamaha. And now I think maybe Zarco's ran into a brick wall because he can't do anything more with the electronic controls that he has, and he can't really do anything more with his setup than what he's at right now. And that's why everybody's looking for this new electronic unit that's supposed to come from Yamaha, that's supposed to come into play and be tested after the Brno race. So that's my take on what's going on at Yamaha and what's going on there.
Perfect. All right. And the last talking point I want to bring up, too, is now Daniello obviously is going to be taking Lorenzo's spot at Ducati. We've seen Lorenzo struggle a little bit. And this year, you know, Dovizioso has not looked himself. Well, he's not looked like he did last year. And Ducati, you know, they say it's better, but the results haven't shown that. Is Ducati in trouble next year with their rider lineup they currently have? It's not really a knock on either one, but let's not say what we're going to say here because, you know, Danilo is not one of the top riders. He's a very good rider. He's going to get you a podium here and there, but he's also going to get you a 10th place too. You know, and Lorenzo, mm-hmm. You know, my whole thing was like, they let Lorenzo go, but what were you going to do to replace him? What guy were you going to get? And there was nobody out there that you were going to snag. So it's kind of like a little, I think a bit of a hit and miss with, and granted, Lorenzo didn't have any wins at the time that this was going mm-hmm. on. They had to do something, but I think Ducati might be in a little bit of trouble here because the bike, remember, they brought Lorenzo in to get the bike over the hump. Mm-hmm. That didn't quite happen. Lorenzo's now going to take, we've seen he's still got the skills. He's going to go over to Honda. That bike knows, that bike has been winning. So he's going to get on a bike where he just has to get himself up to speed. Ducati has still got to get a bike up to speed and have a rider that can win consistently. And I got a feeling they may have a bit of a tough time next year.
I'm going to say no, they've actually done a smart thing. And here's why. I think that Lorenzo's riding style is so far removed from what Dovizioso is riding that this was the only move that they had. I think Lorenzo, with his attitude and his riding style, has been a bit of a poison pill inside of Ducati, right? And I think it's kind of taken some of the focus and attention away from Dovizioso. Now, Dovizioso is not going to sit there and tell you, well, I got to have this, and I got to have that, and blah, 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 blah. But I think it's weighing on him where he sort of used to be the man, right? And then they brought in somebody who was going to be the man, right? And he comprehensively beat the crap out of him the first year that Lorenzo was on the bike. And it was, you know, Ducati was paying the big money and they started kind of listening to Lorenzo to try to make the bike a little bit better. And when they made it and smoothed it and pushed it towards what Lorenzo wanted, they took away from what Dovizioso was good at, right? So Petrucci coming there is used to riding the older Ducatis and riding them in a way that more resembles what Dovizioso does as far as style and technique. So you put the two of them together, you're going to go back and start listening to what Dovizioso wants in a motorcycle. Daniello isn't really going to challenge that because he's just going to kind of ride what's there. And you're going to have a better team because there's going to be more harmony. And you're going to have two guys that are going to kind of want to go in the same direction instead of two guys that are going to be divergent. Now, see, this is where I think Honda may have problems, because if they start to listen to and make changes in how the bike is ridden by the Lorenzo and they start down divergent paths, it may not work. And, you know, the last time we had really a divergent path was 2006, and Honda kind of had the way that Pedrosa wanted to ride an 800, and then you had the way that Pedrosa was riding a 990, and then the way Hayden was riding that 990. And Hayden's bike was really a true HRC Frankenstein kind of bike that he won with. And you might get that same thing happening here again, but the Ducati thing, I think they're better off having Danilo and Dovi. I just think it's a better mix, better, closer style, similar styles, where I think that they can get back to focusing on moving everything in one direction, because really Ducati doesn't have the resources and the manpower to do these two separate things. So I think plus they got Stoner test riding it, and I think Stoner rides the bike a lot more like Dovizioso rides the bike. Yeah, I think things will be better.
There you go. Folks, if you've got an opinion on all of that, feel free to write us in. You can always email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. You can hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. That is the Motopod fan page. You can please like and subscribe for updates. On Twitter, we are @moto_pod. You can follow us there for news and announcements. I am also on Twitter. I am @SkylarV28. Derek, of course, is MotoDerekC on Twitter and Instagram. Andy is @Andy_course. Jim, where can people find you?
Twitter and Instagram @MotoRGV.
Perfect. So we got a little upcoming races here. Suzuka 8-Hour, July 26th. There will be some Moto America races from Utah this weekend. Let's get the hell out of here, Jim.
I agree.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll be back next week to talk a little bit of motorcycles. I think I'm joined by Derek, and we may get some other guests on there. But, Jim, it was great to talk the MotoGP round with you, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to do it.
All right, everyone. See you next week.